Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 20th of May. According to a recent report done by CEOs for Cities, predatory lending and subprime mortgages have taken the blame for the dramatic decrease in housing prices and the glut of foreclosures all over the country. But their analysis shows that the rising fuel costs played a significant role in the collapse of America's housing bubble. The report issued this month, Driven to the Brink, How the Gas Price Spike Popped the Housing Bubble and Devalued the Suburbs, by economist Joseph Courtwright, who is our guest this hour. Growth in housing prices was fueled by low and stable gas prices from 1990 through 2004. Do you remember this? Gas prices $1.10 in early 2002 to almost $4 a gallon today, and it has dealt a major blow to consumer purchasing power and weighs most heavily on those metropolitan areas and the suburbs where people have to drive the farthest. The decline in housing markets strongly correlated with auto dependence. Joe Courtwright is our guest this hour, an economist with Impressa, which is a Portland consulting firm specializing in regional economic analysis, innovation, and industry clusters. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and is the chief economic analyst for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a multi-year private sector-led effort to develop the state economy, and for CEOs for Cities, a national organization of urban leaders. He has served as an advisor to state and local governments, private businesses, foundations, and advocacy groups in more than a dozen states, Canada, and Europe. We'll be welcoming phone calls and welcome your calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee today, it is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Joseph, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
It's hard to remember that gas was $1.10 a gallon not very long ago, isn't it?
Those were the good old days.
Yeah. Those good old days are gone. So the study looked at housing values in five cities. Tell me where you went.
Well, our report focuses on the findings for five cities that are representative, really, of the national market. We looked at Chicago, Los Angeles, Tampa, Florida, Pittsburgh, and Portland, Oregon. But we actually, for the study, looked at a much wider sample. We just simply reported those five cities because they represent a good sort of regional and size balance of different metro markets.
Mm-hmm. And we really haven't looked that much at rising fuel costs playing a significant role in the collapse of the housing bubble, have we? This is somewhat new information.
Yes, I think it is. And the interesting thing is that the timing of the two events match up almost perfectly.
Mm.
Gasoline sort of broke through the $2 a gallon mark at about the same time housing prices crested in roughly 2006. And then as gas prices have continued to increase over the last couple of years, you've seen the housing market actually go into negative territory, which is really a historical first nationally.
Mm. The values you have discovered in close-in neighborhoods, if you have a vibrant city, have held up better, and maybe the only ones where the housing prices continue to increase, is that right?
Well, not the only ones, but you find that relative to the suburban neighborhoods, the close-in neighborhoods in almost every market are doing better. And in some markets where the suburbs are going down, there are actually neighborhoods in the center that are still going up.
Neighborhoods in the center of what?
In the center of the metropolitan area, close to usually the downtown business district.
I see. And what about distant suburbs, and how distant are we talking?
Well, the relationship we looked at really says the further away you go, the more values went down. So we looked at everything typically out to about 30 miles away from the absolute center of the region.
How many miles? I'm sorry.
Up to 30 miles. From the center.
Uh-huh.
So you get people who are in what some folks would call the exurbs. And typically only in very large metropolitan areas do you have a significant number of people living that far away from the center of the region.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the market for higher density and redevelopment in close-in neighborhoods is likely to go stronger, but we need to have local land use plans to accommodate this shift. Are there a lot of cities that are putting together such plans or not?
Well, we're starting to see a lot of interest in accommodating more residential use, particularly in those close-in neighborhoods and in downtowns. But it's still pretty much the exception, because the way that we've planned to grow in the past has really been by growing out rather than by growing up.
Mm-hmm. And we've spent a long time growing out, haven't we?
Absolutely.
So what happens to all of those communities, Joseph? All those communities that were built 30 miles away, are they going to recover? Are we going to see a new use for them?
Well, I think the process of change will be a little bit more subtle. I think the first thing that we're seeing right now is the big decline in prices out there definitely sends a signal to the construction community that says consumers are not willing to pay for that kind of development anymore, or will pay much less. And the construction community will respond by looking for other markets to serve. More broadly, I think we have a challenge of thinking about how to retrofit suburbs for the kinds of things that people want, that give them really more choices about how to travel, and that put things closer at hand. Because one of the things that we've done with our development pattern in the United States is to separate out different kinds of uses, so that commercial uses like stores are all in one part of town, the housing is all in another part of town, and maybe the office and industrial jobs are in still a different place, which makes for a lot of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
But more and more communities are looking at opportunities to do mixed-use development, where all of those things are more jumbled together, which means that you can usually take shorter trips or fewer trips to accomplish the things you need to do on a day.
Mm-hmm. What about those communities, and I guess we're looking at fairly large cities here, that have excellent mass transit?
Yeah, transit is clearly a huge asset because, again, it gives people another set of choices about how to get around. And our data show that cities that have good transit systems and vibrant urban cores are actually ones that have seen their housing values do better than the more sprawling metropolitan areas in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Give me an idea of those areas that are doing very well. Pick a city and a community that's very close to the city and describe what's happening that's good.
Well, again, we looked at whole metropolitan areas. So the metropolitan areas that are doing well include places like Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. And all those places are ones that have pretty good mass transportation systems, and probably just as importantly or relatedly, very strong urban cores. And the places that tend to do the worst in terms of both what's happened with housing prices at the metropolitan level and with foreclosures have been the more sprawling cities, places like Tampa, the South Florida market, and much of Southern California.
Mm-hmm. I would think Los Angeles would be in trouble. You have to drive a long way to get to work there, don't you?
Well, actually, it depends on the neighborhood. There are some neighborhoods where people drive relatively short distances, and then there are some newer places at the fringe of the metropolitan area, like in Riverside County, where people drive very long distances. And we know that people did, over the last few years, a lot of what is called in the real estate community, drive until you qualify, which meant, you know, if you couldn't afford a house close in, you would drive an extra 10 or 15 or 20, even 20 miles to find a house you could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And now, obviously, with the increase in the price of gas, that turns out to not be an economical way to get housing.
Mm-hmm. And the increase really is significant, isn't it? I drive a car that gets pretty good gas mileage, but filling up the tank last week went way over $30, and I just stood there and thought, my gosh, when you add up how much this is going to be on a monthly basis, we're talking a lot of money.
Yeah, I think, you know, people will, for a period of time, sort of, you know, grit their teeth and pay that bill and hope that it gets better. And so that's, you know, we're past that point now, and I think people are really saying, what can I do to cut down on this bill that I really don't enjoy paying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a lot of things that you like to buy and spend your money on and feel like you're getting value, but I think people feel like the amount of money that they're having to spend on fuel now really cuts into things that they would like to spend that money.
Right. What's happening, Joe, in those cities that do have strong central cores and good mass transit? You mentioned Chicago, Seattle, Portland, San Francisco. Are more people moving into the city?
Well, the trouble we have there is getting really current data on what's happening. We know over the last decade and a half, there's been a resurgence in residential development, actually in most metropolitan areas in the United States. But we don't know if that's really gained steam in the last year or so, because it's been masked by, obviously, a much more unsettled housing market. But we think what this means is, as the housing market rebounds, as it's likely to do in the next 2 to 3 years, we'll see those center city neighborhoods do much better. And there is the possibility, if places plan for it, to get more population living closer in.
Mm-hmm. What about those people, and I'm not sure how many of them there are, who have built these McMansions, and sometimes these are really way out of the city. They may be 40 or 50 miles with four-car garages and tons of bathrooms and rooms for the dog and showers for the dog and all of that. I would imagine that those people have enough money that they can pay huge fuel prices, and some of those places would continue to thrive. Is that true?
Oh, sure. And I don't think there's any question that a number of people will still find it desirable to live out there, and will figure out ways to, cut down on the price of gas, or will just be able to afford it, or choose to pay for it rather than other things. But the number of people who will want to do that is going to be less in the future mm-hmm. than it's been in the past. And what that means is, if you're trying to sell that McMansion 5 years or 10 years from now, there'll be fewer people interested in buying it, and they'll be not as willing to pay as much for it as they would for other property where they wouldn't have to drive so much. So I suspect what it'll mean is that the prices will drop out there, and it'll be much less of a good investment than maybe the owner thought it would be at the time they bought it.
And so, do you think eventually they'll disappear?
I don't think they'll disappear, because one of the things we know about the housing and the built environment is it's very durable. It does, once you build a house, once you build a community, they tend to stick around for a long time. And clearly, we see that in our cities. I mean, our cities are essentially the built environment of our grandparents and great grandparents and the decisions that they made. So that housing will certainly be here for a long time. It's just a question, I think, of how desirable it is and how valuable it is and what it gets used for.
Right. Tell me more what you mean by this. One of the policy implications you write in the report is that government can help families save money by making it easy and convenient to live in mixed use, close-in neighborhoods served by transit. What do you mean exactly by mixed use?
Well, again, what we've done in the United States is we've zoned our communities, particularly our suburbs, is to separate different kinds of land uses. So we put our stores in one place and our industries in another and our offices in another place and the residences, the housing. And often different types of housing get put in different places. So the apartments will only be in certain places and the rest will be single-family homes of varying lot sizes. And mixed use says instead of that effort to separate out different kinds of land uses, you integrate those land uses. So, for example, there are residential neighborhoods, and typically dense residential neighborhoods like apartments and condominiums, relatively close, if not intermixed, with things like shopping and services, so that people have a choice when they want to walk or take a bicycle or use transit. And we know that transit works much, much better in those dense, mixed neighborhoods than in these lower density and more separated neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And then where do those people go to work?
Well, that's sort of the other wild card here, is that we know that everybody works in different places, and it's a very dispersed environment. But one of the key things that people have to decide is, when they look for a job, how far from their house do they look for a job? And when they look for a house or a place to live, how far from their job are they willing to commute? And what we know is, as people move and as people change jobs over the next few years, one of the factors that they'll weigh in their mind is, you know, how long of a commute do I want?
Mm-hmm.
And the evidence is that people will look for shorter and shorter commutes.
I hate commuting, don't you? Well, I don't live very far from where I work, but it would be nice to just sort of walk across the street, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the neat things about mixed use is it gives people who want really short commutes more options, because in a lot of cases there isn't the kind of housing or the exact housing you want really close to your job. But if we can do things to redevelop neighborhoods, particularly those close-in neighborhoods, then we give people more choices.
We're going to welcome phone calls because I know a lot of you are living what we're talking about this hour. Joe Courtwright is our guest. He's an economist with Impressa, a Portland consulting firm that specializes in regional economic analysis, innovation, and industry clusters, also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He did the CEOs for Cities report that showed, it was released recently, that predatory lending and subprime mortgages have taken the blame for the dramatic decrease in housing prices and the glut of foreclosures nationwide. But his analysis shows that rising fuel costs have played a significant role in the collapse of America's housing bubble. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send us an email, please do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder that there will be election night NPR coverage of today's primaries in Kentucky and Oregon, and that will start at 9 p.m. Central this evening. So be sure that you tune in tonight to find out about those primaries, and of course we'll have analysis tomorrow morning. Joe Courtwright is our guest right now. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we start our calls, Joe, with Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I think that, you know, I'm all for public transportation and everything else. I just think it's kind of the real estate people are looking for scapegoats. I don't think the housing bubble had anything to do with gasoline. It had to do with the liquidity, the free flowing credit, and really a lot of people in collusion to drive prices up and make profits and this and that. And people that live in the suburbs, they come out here there's a lot of reasons they move, but the people, like where my kids go to school, I noticed the other day there is not any locks on the bicycles. And it's like, because that's the suburbs. People aren't going to go to the city that if they don't have to. And I'm in the landlord business. I run an ad. I get 60 calls. My tenants live out here in the country, and they drive all the way to Milwaukee, and they're glad to do it. And to blame the housing bubble on gasoline, I mean, that's totally, I think you missed the ball.
Joe. Well,
Daryl, first of all, let me just be clear. I'm not saying that the gasoline caused the housing bubble, but I think our point is that the rising price of gasoline popped the housing bubble.
Mm.
And the factors that you discussed, you know, are sort of the classic factors that drove housing prices on the upside, that there was a lot of liquidity in the market. There was this built-in set of expectations that housing prices would always rise. And the nature of bubbles is they tend to keep growing as long as the psychology in the marketplace stays the same. And the critical thing that's changed over the last few years in the market is the price that consumers have to pay for gasoline. So our point is that the gas price spike popped the bubble, not that it caused it to grow in the first place. Hadn't been gas prices, it would have been something else at some point. We knew that housing prices wouldn't keep going up forever.
Right.
Oh, yeah. People, they get where people can't afford them, and then, you know, you got to go where your market is. If there's not the big high-paying jobs, people can't afford $250,000 houses.
Right.
They mean to build small houses, affordable housing. I had a friend come over here from Sweden. I used to live in a little cottage, and he said, boy, I'm glad to come to your house, because everybody else around here has these huge houses, and how do they heat them? And my little house, our heating bill, our electric bill was $30. Our heat bill was $80.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's the kind of houses they need to build. You can't have, you know, you can't have five bedrooms and three bathrooms and everything. You got to heat that house.
Yeah. How long a drive is it from Exonia to, if you work in the city, downtown Milwaukee?
That's about 40, 45 minutes.
That's a long drive. That's a lot of money in gas in a month, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, my tenants all have cell phones. They all have cable TV. Like I told my wife, Americans have money. They just don't want to spend it on gas. So, I mean, everybody's got other little toys. You're going to have to maybe put some of them toys away.
Mm-hmm. Joe?
Yeah, and I think you're right. Nobody gets a lot of pleasure out of the money that they spend on their gas bill. And I think what we're saying is, you know, not that everybody's going to pick up and move, but there's going to be this mass exodus from the suburbs, but that a lot of people are going to question, you know, how much money they want to spend to live further out. And I think what you'll see is more and more people looking to find desirable close-in neighborhoods, and that includes ones with, you know, a good sense of security and, you know, good neighborhoods and great schools. Mm-hmm. So those are all still positives.
Does it also precipitate a change in the energy use in this country and a change in what kind of energy we are using? Do you see a growth in green movements as a result of this really high price of gas, Joe?
Well, I think that's really the larger trend here. We knew that even before gas prices started going up, there was a segment of the marketplace, particularly among younger consumers, where having green characteristics in the development and opportunities to conserve energy, whether it was in heating or cooling your dwelling or in transportation, which turns out to be the biggest use of energy for Americans, we knew a lot of consumers were looking for that. And I think the rising prices are just accelerating people's interest in living greener.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Daryl, very much for your call. Jack from Eagle River, hello.
Yes, good morning to you. I wanted to point to a phenomenon which occurs in a lot of cities, but Chicago's the one I'm most familiar with because I read the Trib every day. And the phenomenon is the high-rise condos. It's unbelievable, the proliferation of these buildings. Mm-hmm. And to top it all, they're going to build something called the Spire, which is a very thin thing that looks like this soft ice cream, you know, goes all the way up. And it's going to be twice the height of the Sears Tower. Now, and the prices for the condos within that building will be from $1 million up to, I think, it's maybe even $40 million.
Woo!
Oh, it's unbelievable. So I'm thinking Europeans, Arabs, you know, that's the first point. Second point is, it's so ironic that people who can afford those places could put their car away and walk to all the entertainment, the restaurants, anything they want. And I think that's cruel, you know. Us poor folks have to use our cars and can hardly afford to have them. And these wealthy folks down in these interior high-rises, so that's a plus side as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, that's enough of that.
Joe.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the Spire.
I haven't either.
That'd be quite a development if it happened.
I can't imagine living on the top of one of those buildings. I'd feel like I was swaying all the time. So this income disparity plays into this as well, Joe, which we've already hinted at.
Well, we know that some of the first development that we've seen in downtown areas is often very high-income housing.
Mm-hmm.
And that in itself represents kind of a switch in the marketplace, because for a long time, the wealthier you were, the further out that you tended to live. And I think the caller, that Jack, has a really good point that one of the things that's really attractive about downtown living is you don't have to drive. Everything's very close at hand. And I think the big challenge for public policy and cities is to figure out ways that you can have more affordable housing in those close-in neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And what about the jobs? I'm fairly familiar with the Chicago area from years ago, granted, but I recall seeing a lot of people driving from, you know, little communities right outside Chicago into the suburban areas to do their jobs, and sometimes jobs that probably don't pay very much money. Are we seeing simultaneously more jobs that are being generated close to cities and in cities to make it desirable to work there? What's happening to jobs in these exurban suburban areas?
Well, one of the things that we know about cities and urban economies is that the jobs are generally much closer to the center and much more concentrated in the center. That's why in the typical metropolitan area, the flow of commuting is inward. That is, you know, people tend to live in the suburbs and then commute in towards the center.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who live closer in generally have much better access to the jobs that are there. One of the interesting things we've seen in the last few years in a number of metropolitan areas is the rise of so-called reverse commuting, where people choose to live very close to the center and commute outwards to jobs, which actually turns out to be a really good thing, because that means, you know, we usually have plenty of road capacity going in that direction, and so it doesn't force us to invest in, you know, expensive new highways. And so.
Thanks, Jack, so much for your call. Charlie from La Crosse, hi.
Yeah, hi, Joe. Thanks for taking my call. Interesting show. I have one of the, it's not a huge, but a mansion in the country on 43 acres, and I just want to offer a point that folks who have a place like mine, if they have acreage that is included with that and a pole shed, and another way to look at this is some self-sufficiency out in the country. I get accused of being paranoid at times, but, you know, if pandemic flu or something like that, a very positive thing of being out in the country in a place like this is that point. And, you know, also it's worth it. The gasoline that I purchased, I wake up this morning, I can see my horses out the back door here. But I am considering a motorcycle possibly to get into work. And with that comes added worries about, you know, a deer crossing the road or having an accident and ending up in a hospital. I'd like to appreciate your points on
that. How far away from La Crosse do you work? Do you work in La Crosse?
Correct.
Okay.
And so I have a very delightful, it's about a half-hour commute into the city, kind of over the river and through the woods, and very relaxing before and after my shift. So I do believe there's a value in that as well.
Uh-huh. Joe?
Yeah, I think there's no question that you know, people like a little bit of downtime, usually, between you know, leaving work and getting home, and it's nice to have a break. And there's certainly some real attractive components to living in the country and, you know, having more proximity to nature and, you know, have horses and so on. And I think the big thing that we're seeing is just that there are fewer people who will find that economically attractive in the future. The amount that you'll have to pay for gasoline, or the fact that you'll, you know, have to think about having a motorcycle rather than a car, is going to weigh on the minds of some people when they make that decision. And fewer people, I think, will want to make that choice.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the report about suburban households spending more of their income on transportation and gas, and so they've taken the biggest hit to their budgets, and as a result, less income to spend on housing. How big a hit is it to their budgets?
Well, we have some really good research that's been done by some folks in Chicago at the Center for Neighborhood Technology that looks at how much money people spend on transportation and on gasoline, depending on how far away they live or how far their suburb is from the center of the city. And there's a very strong relationship. And the typical American household spends something on the order of about 5% of its income on gas. But it's a lot more for some of the households, particularly if you live way out in the country, you'll spend a much bigger fraction of your income on gasoline. And we know that that's essentially doubled in the last, you know, 4 years or so. And so as a result, it can be, you know, 10, 11, 12% of your income. And that, you really notice that.
Right. Add that with the fuel costs for the homes that are quite large, and you're paying a ton. Mary from Madison is next. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I'm sorry I missed part of the earlier call, because nothing surprised me more. I've had a chance to spend quite a bit of time in Europe than how modestly affluent people were living in Europe at that time. The small cars, the good public transportation, everything that everybody has talked about since then, affluent people seem to have very little desire to express their financial state in the kind of homes that they had purchased. Now, for the last 30-odd years, I've lived in a very pretty part of western Dane County, and it has been staggering to see the kind of money that's moved out here and the enormous homes they've built for three or four people. However, according to our local realtor, there are at least 30 of these mega mansions around us now, back in the Dells, that have been for sale for a long, long time. I don't think it's that these people can't afford to live out here anymore. I think they're just bad bored. Because the first thing you notice is, once you put your house out here, the job is still downtown. Often the kids' schools are still near the city. All their friends are there. And living like that almost requires the presence of one adult full-time, usually the wife, of course, who does nothing but live in the car, mm-hmm. chauffeuring back and forth. However, there's a second group out here, and I'd have to say by 3:30 in the morning, it's bumper to bumper, 50 miles out of town. There's a whole group of young families that bought homes in surrounding communities, much smaller, essentially rural communities. that couldn't afford to buy homes in Madison, and now they're absolutely caught. And I thought perhaps your speaker would say something about the fact that in our pie-in-the-sky future, maybe there'll be lots of mixed-use neighborhoods and people will realize they have to live closer to town.
And where are they?
That's going to be a long time from now.
Where are they going at 3:30 in the morning?
Into Madison. Into
really?
Madison from Spring Green, from Dubuque.
Oh, my.
It's just something to see. If you were out here when there were no stoplights, there was still a feed mill. And it's so interesting to watch the progress of these two groups, the very affluent group, who for the most part seem simply to be bored because there's really not much going on out here if your whole life has been in Madison. Now, they're lovely neighbors. They're educated. They're affluent. They have beautifully behaved kids that do well in school, the whole catastrophe. And I've certainly enjoyed all of them, but I have to wonder if this group is gradually going to dissipate, and what is going to happen to the very young families that signed up for a 50 or 60 mile commute?
Yeah,
because that's where they could afford the houses.
Joe,
well, the Mary makes a really good point that people who bought that distant house back when gasoline cost a buck and a quarter a gallon thought that the economic proposition looked pretty favorable, and that house seemed very reasonably priced, and now they're kind of caught. And there's no quick or easy way out of that. You have a mortgage payment to make, and you've got to get into work. Now, some people will say, look to move back in closer. Some people, like Charlie, will say, I'm going to get a motorcycle or a more fuel-efficient vehicle. But in the short term, there's some really difficult adjustments to make. In the longer term, and I think Europe is a good example here, the standard of living in Europe is very, very similar to what it is in the United States, but people live, as Mary notes, with a lot smaller cars and generally speaking in much, much smaller houses. And they make those choices because they've faced a different set of prices over the last several decades. And that's sort of the environment that we will more be in the future, where we're paying a much, much higher price for energy and for gasoline.
Right. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Joanne from Des Moines. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Glad to be able to talk to you this morning. What's been bugging me for a long time, even before the gas got so high, was the lack of light rail from suburbs into town.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time I was thinking of reduced costs for keeping up the highways and the bridges that are dropping in Minneapolis and various other places. They're looking terrible because of flooding and so forth. But now we have another incentive to get those light rails back in service from the suburbs into where the jobs are. So people don't have to move downtown if they don't want to. This was going on in the 40s. My parents worked as a butler and cook for the vice president of Alden's Catalog in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was also his chauffeur. He just drove him to a little stop for this light rail. The man got on every single day, rode an hour into downtown Chicago. Work came back. My dad picked him up at the depot. Of course, today they don't have chauffeurs that do that. They just hop in their cars that are waiting for them.
Mm-hmm.
They put in a light rail down at Houston. My son lives there, and he says it is full all the time. It's possible. It's doable. Little Perry, Iowa, now it's a suburb of Des Moines, Iowa, the capital city, in the early 1900s, had an electric rail car. All it did every day was go down to Des Moines, come back,
mm-hmm.
go down to Des Moines, come back. This was in like 1910, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to get a calendar that had some old pictures on it, and my husband had told me about it anyway because he'd been a native of that area. Well, there we go. All those people can read the paper, use their computer when they're going down to the big city or up to the big city, wherever it may be, getting ready for work. They're all rested. They didn't have to fight traffic. they didn't have to avoid killing a kid crossing the street illegally to go to his school.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think it's out there, and we got to grab these opportunities. Haven't they been doing that in Europe for eons?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
we used to have it right, didn't we? Milwaukee was the same thing. We had a rail system that went from the North Shore area to downtown Milwaukee, and it was all dismantled. I would imagine a lot of other communities at the turn of the century or a little bit beyond those years had much better plans than what they have now. Joe.
Yeah, up until the 1950s in the United States, until about 1950, in fact, we built our cities on sort of the streetcar model, that you had usually electric transit and relatively higher levels of density. And actually, up until about 1945, it was not the case that a majority of households owned a car. So we had a much more balanced set of choices that we developed in a way where people could take advantage of automobiles. And sometimes it wasn't because you owned one, but because you had friends that had one. And you also had a much more viable system of transit. And what we're seeing right now is across the country in just the last year is a big jump in use of the transit system, particularly in those places like Dallas and other cities that have made an investment recently in putting in rail transit.
Right. Thanks, Joanne, for your call. We go to Scott from Milwaukee next. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I'm one of those who made the jump from the suburbs to the city. My wife and I bought a mixed-use building. We live upstairs. I work downstairs. So I love my morning commute.
I'll bet.
And, you know, I do save on gas. I'm downtown, so I'm close to bus lines and Amtrak to Chicago if I need to travel there. But what I've found that may be unique to a mixed-use building, but I'm asking your guest if he's looked into these issues, because I'm in a mixed-use building, I'm taxed a little bit differently. My building is assessed as a commercial property rather than a residential property. My furnace is taxed. I have higher insurance rates. These are added expenses that I'm now incurring because I've chosen to live the way I do. And while I don't want to move back out, I'm just wondering, do we also need to look politically or with the insurance industry in how these bodies view people who are moving and working back downtown in some of these more alternative situations so that we're not priced out of the market?
Oh, that's really a terrific question and observation, because so much of the way we've developed in the United States really has reflected a pretty strong bias towards suburban development at the edge of the metropolitan area. And it's very difficult sometimes to do residential uses and even commercial redevelopment in downtown areas. A lot of places now essentially have, for example, in addition to the things the caller mentioned, parking requirements for development. So that if you've got an old building that's maybe vacant and you want to redevelop it for commercial or residential use, you can do that, but only if you provide off-street parking for the use, which in many cases makes it uneconomical. And then we've also put burdens in terms of insurance and other requirements on doing things in close-in neighborhoods. And that's the kind of public policy that we need to take a close look at and see whether that's really consistent with the way we want our cities to develop.
Mm-hmm. Did you used to live quite differently, Scott?
Well, I lived 20 miles, well, you know, Milwaukee area. I lived out in Waukesha, and so if I had to go downtown regularly, I mean, that's a 20 to 30-minute commute.
Right.
You know, that was long enough that I didn't enjoy it. I still have business in Chicago, so I do enjoy taking the train because I can read, work, and get accomplished other things on my travel down. But just from a daily perspective, that's what I wanted to get rid of, was my daily commute.
Right.
And so now I've done that, but I've opened up another can of worms, in a sense, with some of these other issues that, you know, do I need to just fight City Hall? Do I need to go to the state and start clamoring, making noise about how we can be, we as individuals who live and work in a building can be looked at, taxed, or judged differently?
Right.
Because, yes, I feel I am being treated differently because of the choices that I've made, and it's a financial burden on myself.
Right. I understand.
Yeah, and let me just mention that one of the things Scott's doing is, you know, he's taking two cars a day off whatever the road is between Waukesha and Milwaukee.
Right.
And that turns out to be, you know, probably the biggest expense of your state highway department is providing enough capacity for those peak hour commuters moving from the suburbs to the city. So there's a real public value to encouraging more people to live and work in places close, particularly downtown, but in those close-in urban neighborhoods.
So it is time to go visit City Hall. Right, Joe?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. We're looking at a report just released by CEOs for Cities, written by our guest, economist Joseph Courtwright. And it is a new analysis showing that rising fuel costs have played a very large role in the collapse of America's housing bubble. Our number is, and we have one line open right now, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers 414-227-2050. Or if you would like to send an email, you could do that at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, we'll talk with the authors of Fixing Failed States, a Framework for Rebuilding a Fractured World. We go back to phone calls now for Joseph Courtwright, and our next caller is Carl from Milwaukee. Hi, Carl.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I was wondering if over a protracted period of time, as we see many American cities reluctant to do more with public transportation to the suburbs, if perhaps we may see a shift toward what the socioeconomic demographics that are seen around many large Latin American cities, whereby the more impoverished areas are not in the cities themselves, but surrounding the cities, particularly as real estate in the cities becomes more valuable as people do gravitate toward the central part of the cities. We've seen this a lot in Milwaukee, for example, with the condo booms. Could you comment on that?
Sure. And actually, the U.S. is kind of unusual in having a typical situation where inner city neighborhoods, close-in neighborhoods, are poorer than the neighborhoods on the fringe. In most of the developed world, the highest income housing and high income people tend to be concentrated more in the center. That's true, as the caller notes, in the third world. But if you were to go to Paris, for example, the most expensive housing is in the absolute center of the community, and it's really the suburbs where you find concentrations of poverty. Now, that's not, they haven't managed that altogether well. We know that there were some serious problems with, you know, racial and ethnic strife in Paris just a few years ago. But I think that's much more of the model that we'll see in the United States over the next few decades. And we're already seeing it in terms of high-income people moving back into the cities.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. And we go next to Chuck from Lake Delton. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thank
Good.
You. Say, in the 1950s, I don't know if I'm old enough to remember, but you probably, all of you probably aren't, but in the 1950s, General Motors and Standard Oil came along and convinced a lot of these cities to use diesel buses as far as their transportation and stuff like that in the cities and going out there on the condition that they would tear up all their local tracks and electric cars and trolley cars and stuff like that. So General Motors kind of and the oil, Standard Oil kind of came along and bribed them to get rid of everything that was efficient and use the buses.
Well, I think that, and there's certainly an element of truth to that the major corporations accelerated the decline of transit, but really the demise of transit, particularly the old rail systems, streetcar systems in the United States, was a lot like Agatha Christie's murder on the Orient Express. It turns out that everybody did it. The public sector basically assumed that everybody would be driving cars. Gasoline was priced very cheaply. And people, frankly, left those transit systems in large, large numbers because cars were so much more convenient and so cheap. And so we all have a measure of responsibility for what happened to the demise of transit in the United States. And And we've seen just how difficult it is to reverse that once we disinvest in it.
We have an email, Larry from Madison. Do you think that, this is along the lines of the caller before the last one, do you think that most suburbs will share the same fate as certain sections of inner cities? Will inner cities be able to repair those lost neighborhoods? And finally, what will happen to those disadvantaged people?
Boy, those are three tough questions. I think, again, I expect this process to be a lot more subtle than rather than cataclysmic. I don't expect that, you know, suburbs to turn into slums overnight. Certainly not. I think the challenge is for public policy to think about ways to redevelop and retrofit suburbs so that they continue to accommodate a mix of different incomes. And suburbs have clearly become much more economically and ethnically diverse over the last couple of decades, and I think that's actually a good thing. And then the final question, I'm sorry, had to do with...
What will happen to the people?
Oh, yeah, and that's, you know, obviously that's something we care a lot about, and I think people, assume that the housing market determines whether people are wealthy or not, and that's really, I think, a larger, you know, economic challenge of, you know, how we create economic opportunity in the country and what kind of policies that we have that help raise up the economic opportunities of people who are faring least well under our system. So what we do with things like job training and a minimum wage and the like. I tend to separate out economic opportunity from the way the housing market works.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chuck, so much for your call. We go to David from Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yes, my thing is making cities more kid-friendly. I always thought they should take a city block, make an apartment building that goes all the way around and have big inner courtyard. Kids run loose and they can't get to the streets. And about econ, I just heard that the rich are living with the rich and the poor are living with the poor. I grew up where the doctor lived on the street from me, and you didn't view the rich as these because you actually knew one of them, and the rich knew the poor, and that really help heal. You know, they're more likely to give to the poor and vice versa, you know, versus, you know, all the rich moving into, then they think of us as welfare some, and then we think of the rich as greedy people because you don't know none.
Joseph.
That's a great observation.
Yeah.
And one of the projects we're working on at CEOs for Cities, which is this national organization of urban leaders, is a project called Kids in Cities, which is addressing exactly that question of how is it that we make cities work better for families with children, and particularly for families who have choices about where to live. Because in a lot of cases, we know in the United States that the families with choices have left the cities because they're concerned about safety, because they're concerned about where their kids play, and because they're concerned about schools. And we think one of the key factors in revitalizing cities is making them desirable places for families.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very much on our agenda. And David's point is exactly correct that, you know, we know our country works best when people of all different income groups and ethnic groups have the opportunity to interact with each other on a regular basis.
I visited in some neighborhoods in Calgary, in Canada, where, I mean, what a wonderful design. Really, the front is the back and the back is the front, so that they have sidewalks and it's all enclosed and there are parks so that your garage is on the other side. You know what I'm saying? The garage is on the back side of the house,
right.
And then it's this huge, wonderful park area and a huge community where you can feel extremely safe when you let your children out. I thought, what a great idea. Why don't we do that?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that people miss, I think, about the opportunity of places with more density and more walking is there are more people on the street, there are more eyes on the street, there's more essentially kind of social supervision.
Right.
As opposed to communities where people do most of their traveling sort of enclosed in these metal and glass containers where they don't interact with one another and where they're traveling at 30 or 40 miles an hour. And so
it
becomes very impersonal.
Yes.
Now, walking places are much more, as we know, personal and social places.
Yeah. Thanks, David, very much for your call. And we go next to Bob from Appleton. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. I wanted to ask your guest if he did any research on the possibility of shifting our paradigm completely and looking at telecommuting and video conferencing as an alternative and get rid of the office buildings and give companies incentives around taxes so that every car they bring off the road, they get a tax credit.
Okay, we have about 15 seconds, Joe.
Yeah, telecommuting is a good supplement, but it's hard to see how it replaces the kind of close personal interaction that most jobs depend on.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, were you good? That was 14 seconds. Joseph, thank you so much. It was a really interesting conversation, and thanks for the report.
My pleasure.
We have been talking with Joe Courtwright, an economist with Impressa, a Portland consulting firm that specializes in regional economic analysis, innovation, and industry clusters. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and chief economic analyst for the Oregon Business Plan. CEOs for Cities did this report, Driven to the Brink, How the Gas Price Spike Popped the Housing Bubble and Devalued the Suburbs. And our guest, economist Joseph Courtwright, wrote the report. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your most interesting calls, everybody. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll have the conversation then continue.